So welcome everyone. It's a pleasure today to have Aurélien Barreau. He's gonna tell us about question number modes of black holes, modified and quantum gravity, and let Aurélien take it away.
Okay, so thanks a lot for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm going to tell you a few words about our last work on quasi-normal modes of black holes in modified and quantum gravity. Okay, so I cannot change slide. Okay, it works perfect. So as we all know, black holes are simple. I mean, they are simple because they have no scale. They are simple because they are described only by a few parameters. And to some extent, we expect their quasi-normal modes to be simple also. Because basically, quasi-normal modes are free oscillations. So they do not depend on the initial perturbations. And we don't have to care about the matter content because black holes are just vacuum solutions of the Einstein Fields equation. So you don't need to specify a complicated equation of state, for example, that would be required to study the quasi-normal modes of a dense star or something like that. However, the modes are not exactly normal just because this is an open system, which means that we are losing energy through the emission of gravitational waves. So basically, quasi-normal modes are just the relaxation process of a slightly disturbed black hole, which goes back to equilibrium. So when looking at the event of merging of two black holes, we have this in spiral phase followed by the merging itself, and then this exponentially damped tail, which basically corresponds to the emission of quasi-normal modes in the last stage of the process. And this is what we are going to discuss now. Okay, so the framework is quite simple. You just have to split your metric in a background part plus a small perturbation, and then you are done with solving the linearized Einstein field equations in vacuum. So what makes this problem quite appealing, I think, and interesting beyond the results themselves are the somehow original and unusual boundary conditions, because you want the waves to be purely outgoing at infinity, because there is no source in the problem, and purely ingoing at the event horizon, just because nothing can escape, right, a classical black hole. So this is something quite strange, because you want a wave to go away at infinity to enter the black hole, and you have sources nowhere. So basically, the question here is not really to solve a wave equation. The other way around, the question is to try to find a set of frequencies for which the wave equation has solution, taking into account those very strange boundary conditions. And the result is that this corresponds to a countable set of complex frequencies. So the radial part can be written in this way, and the complex frequency can be split into a real and an imaginary part. The real part is just the usual frequency, which corresponds to the period of the emitted waves, the inverse period of the emitted waves. And the imaginary part is basically the damping rate, just because, of course, we are losing energy. So intuitively speaking, if this imaginary part is negative, we have an exponential damping, and therefore the system is stable. If it is positive, we have an exponential growth, and the system seems to be unstable. I have to say seems to be, because quite surprisingly, only the stability of Minkowski space have been rigorously mathematically demonstrated to the best of my knowledge, which is not extremely exciting from a physicist viewpoint, because it could be that the growing solution simply requires a non-perturbative treatment. You cannot anymore use only small perturbations, and therefore the instability is not fully established. This is not very important from a phenomenological viewpoint anyway. So just to fix ideas, let me begin with a scattering equation. We have to be very clear that the process of quasi-normal modes is different from the process of computing, for example, gray body factors, that is, the interaction of a quantum field with a black hole. However, it appears that the wave equation is nearly the same. So there are strong mathematical similarities between the two problems. So we can just begin by writing down the Klein-Gordon equation in the background of the black hole, or in the background of any object, by the way, by replacing the usual derivatives by the covariant derivatives. And then this equation can be rewritten by a change of variable in a kind of Schrödinger-like equation. And this remains true not only for scalars, but also for fermions. And this Schrödinger-like equation has a potential, which basically describes the scattering properties. And this potential is nearly the same for the computation of gray body factor and for the computation of quasi-normal modes. So to understand what is going on, I believe that it is useful to write down the metric in this form. So this is axis symmetric, but actually due to the spherical symmetry of the background space-time, you can always go back to this specific form by a rotation if you want to get rid of the exponential I n phi terms. And at this point, it appears that there are two different kinds of perturbations. So perturbations that give small values to metric coefficients that were initially zero. So in this case, it means omega Q2 and Q3. And such perturbations will induce a kind of frame dragging effect. And they are called the axial perturbations. On the other hand, we have perturbations that just give small increments to already non-vanishing metric coefficients. So associated with nu, nu2, nu3, and psi, and they are called the polar perturbations. Obviously, those names also mean that they have different symmetry transformation properties under parity. The quite fascinating point is that the potential for axial perturbations and for polar perturbations seems to be very different. They are not at all the same. They're called Regge-Wheeler and Zerilli. And the fact is that they share exactly the same set of eigenmodes. That is, they are isospectral. This is exactly true for Schwarzschild black hole, for Kerr black hole, for Reichstein-Nordström black hole, for Kerr-Newman black holes, for all the classical black holes. I will come back later to this very interesting property.
Just a question.
Oh, sorry.
It's me. Yeah, you mentioned that the wave equation is similar, but not to the gray body factor. But aren't they exactly the same wave equation?
They are not exactly the same. There are small, little differences in the potential. The potential has the same shape, but not exactly with the same coefficient. So there are slight differences. So those quasi-normal modes have been calculated. This is the imaginary part as a function of the real part with this very nice pattern. So mnemotechnically, you can think either to a uterus or to a bulge curl. This looks like the same. But more seriously, the point is the following. We are now entering the era of experimental measurement of quasi-normal modes. So let me point out this PRL paper from last year. They reanalyzed the first LIGO event of binary black hole merger, and using observations beginning at the peak of the signal, they found evidence for the fundamental quasi-normal mode, for at least one overtone, and for probably a second overtone. So we now not only measure the fundamental, but we also see higher overtones of the quasi-normal modes. So this really opens quite fascinating possibilities, and this is probably worth studying that a bit more into the details. So I'm going to focus now on theories beyond JR. Of course, we all know this, but I cannot resist the pleasure to remind us that going beyond JR is not something obvious. It's not something we should do easily, just because of the famous Lovelock theorem, the only second order local gravitational field equations derivable from an action containing only the four-dimensional metric tensor are the Einstein field equations with a cosmological constant, of course, because in D equals 4, we have D over 2 equal 2 independent tensors that can be put in front of the T mu nu. So we all know that, of course, this is basics, but we have to keep in mind that going beyond JR is not recklessly, I mean, we need very strong motivations to do that. It can be done because the hypothesis of the theorems can be overcome by diffeomorphism invariance violation, by weak equivalence principle violations, by higher dimensions, or by extra fields. So this is the nice plot. The real life situation is a bit messy. I took this slide from Baker. There are many different models of extended and modified gravity. In my opinion, some are well motivated, others are probably very arbitrary. But in any case, we should keep in mind that Einstein gravity is something very special. I mean, it's not one theory among the others. It's a very, very specific theory. So this being said, let's do it anyway. Let's try to go beyond JR with, I hope, some good motivations. So if you want to calculate the quasi-normal modes beyond JR, you have to go back to the line element, the metric, with a function f, which is a priori different from the Schwarzschild case. I'm going to focus now on non-rotating black holes. The effective potential can be analytically computed for any function f. The situation is slightly more involved if one considers two different functions here for the temporal and for the radial parts, but still you can once again analytically compute the potential. So it was already known, but we derived quite more usable, I think, formulae. So this is the potential that can be used to compute the axial modes for the quasi-normal oscillations. You see that this function A here enters the game, this function H enters the game, and it seems that there is no function B, but actually the function B is hidden here in the tortoise coordinate. Okay, so the function B is here through the R star. Okay, so we have the machinery. So now we can begin to calculate those gray body factors. So technically speaking, I'm going to use a sixth order WKB approximation scheme, basically set by Konoplya. There are many different known ways to have good estimates of the quasi-normal modes, but I think this one is especially is very useful in the sense that it allows you to control what you are doing and to really change the parameters to control the accuracy. And as long as you don't go to very high overtone numbers, it is probably very, it's not probably, it can be shown that it is very reliable.
So just a question, are you talking about the numerical methods for the evaluation or is it theoretical?
Yes, so WKB is analytical, right? But there are also numerical methods that are very effective. But the problem is that in the WKB scheme, you really know your uncertainty because you have a formulae which give you how far you are from the real result, and they are very, very precise. The numerical approximations are not very easy to handle. So probably
so the WKB is it very good for high quantum number and it's very bad for the low lying number?
Yes, exactly. You need to go to a high hell to have a good precision.
And the one we measure, the measurements you mentioned are about the low one, right?
Yes. But we have checked that we are really under control. Okay. So anyway, I have to tell you right now that I am not going to give relevant numbers just because what I am interested in here are the trains. So I am using deformation parameters that are way beyond the experimental bounds. So please don't ask me about the numerical values of the evolution that I'm going to show now. In the second part, I will come back to this point in a more accurate way. But now I'm just trying to show you how it moves. So I won't do justice to any of the model I consider. So the point I want to underline, to address, is can we distinguish between extended gravity models by looking at the quasi-normal modes, basically. So first, let's consider massive gravity. As we know, one of the first motivation was to try to account for the accelerated expansion of the universe by generating a kind of Yuka-like potential for gravitation. There were ghosts in the initial version that were cured in the DRGT framework. There were also, you know, this famous problem of discontinuity, because when the mass of the graviton goes to zero, you do not recover linearized general relativity. And this is this has been solved by the ideas from Cédric Defayet and others. So right now, the theory is still alive. And starting from this action where U is the potential for the gravitons, one obtains black hole solutions that take this form, where the new parameters gamma and epsilon are related to the fundamental parameter, that is the mass of the graviton, plus quite a lot of constants that are constrained experimentally and theoretically. So in this plot, I show you the quasi-normal modes. So let me be clear, the black dots here correspond to the Schwarzschild case. The colored dots correspond to this modified gravity model. When you go from the left to the right, you increase the deformation parameter. So in this case, the graviton mass. Those points correspond to L equal 2, L equal 3, L equal 4. And when you go from the back to the upper side, you just increase the overtone number. So N equal 0, N equal 1, N equal 2, N equal 3. Okay, you cannot go beyond just because of the accuracy of the WKB method. Okay, so what appears here is that when you increase the graviton mass, first you change the real part of the imaginary frequency, which means that you increase the frequency of the quasi-normal modes, but you also increase slightly the imaginary part, which means that the damping rate is increasing. But interestingly, this increase is happening only for high overtone numbers and is not present for low overtone numbers. So there is a kind of refined structural pattern in the modification of the quasi-normal modes. Let me focus on scalar tensor vector gravity now. So we allow the gravitational constant, the vector field coupling, and the vector field mass to vary with space and time. We choose, well, maybe I should say a few words. We know that this theory allows one to recover, for example, the rotation curves of galaxy. It has been recently put, in my opinion, under strong phenomenological pressure. So I will not vote for this model, but it is not completely dead. So maybe it is worth being studied. So we focus on the most interesting phenomenological case where the B mu nu is nonlinear. B mu nu is this tensor which is defined through the vector, the derivative of the vector field. And we consider the case where the parameter alpha, which enters the definition of the renormalized gravitational coupling, is small enough so that we still have a black hole solution. Otherwise, we don't have any horizon at all. So the metric function now takes this form, and we can play the same game and try to understand how the quasi-normal modes vary when this alpha parameter varies. And the result is that the frequency is still increasing, but the damping rate is now completely insensitive to the value of alpha. So you change the frequency, but you do not change the characteristic time for the exponential damping. What happens in Orszay-Lifshitz gravity is quite different. So you know that this model bets on the fundamental nature of the quantum theory instead of relying on the general relativistic principles and symmetries. So this is basically a renormalizable uvicomplete theory, which is not Lorentz invariant in 3+1 dimensions, in the sense that the usual relativistic time is only recovered in the large distance limit. So Orszay-Lifshitz, it's not very intuitive, at least to me. So I will not give you the intuitive sense of this beta parameter, which is actually the inverse of the parameter entering the effective Lagrangian. But still, you can check that for beta equals zero, you recover the Schwarzschild black hole. And the results are interesting because the frequency is still increasing when the deformation parameter increase, but the damping rate is very strongly decreasing. So we have once again a different behavior. We can also consider what I call here H-bar corrections, just means the usual quantum correction to the Newtonian gravitational potential that can be obtained without having a full quantum theory of gravity, that is by making a kind of perturbative treatment. So in that case, the metric takes this form. And the results are quite strongly different because here the real part is decreasing when you increase this, I cannot call that a deformation parameter, but at least this quantum parameter, because h bar is here. So in this case, the frequency is now decreasing. And to finish this this little tour, let's say a few words about loop quantum gravity black holes. So as you know, loop quantum gravity is a non-perturbative and background invariant quantization of JR. Basically, in LQG, a black hole is defined by the concept of an isolated horizon, which has the advantage to be local and non-theological. And the punctures between the spin network and this horizon defines little cells of areas, because the spin network carries quantum numbers that are associated with the representation of SU2 that are chosen, and the intertwiners carry some kind of atoms of space. And there are many different descriptions of black holes in this framework. So it's a very lively field. There are many, many, many recent papers. And I'm going to focus on a quite unusual model even within LQG, that is a polymeric black hole, just for the reason that this is a framework in which we still have quantum effect possibly outside the horizon, which might not be true in the other settings. So the metric is not very friendly. So you have two different functions here, G and F. And the fundamental parameters that enter this metric, I don't need to define the terms in details, are the polymerization parameter and the minimal area gap of the theory. And the interesting point here is that when you increase this polymerization parameter, the frequency begins to increase, and then it decreases. So there is a non-monotonic behavior. And the physical reason for that is that we have two different scales here. We have this fundamental era, we have this area, we have this polymerization parameter, and there is a kind of competition between both effects. So I won't bother you with other examples. We have studied other examples, but I think that's enough. And let me go to the conclusion. I mean, the conclusion is that distinguishing between models with quasi-normal modes is difficult. First, because as I have said, I have used very large values of the parameters for in all the cases that I have shown, the plots correspond to values that are beyond the experimental bounds. In addition, there are many degeneracies because, of course, we do not know the intrinsic characteristics of the black holes we are studying. We don't know the values of the parameter even within a given beyond general relativistic model. And of course, I have considered only Schwarzschild black holes, that is not real life black holes. And the work should be extended to the Kerr case. So no precise results can be derived from this. However, some trends can be underlined. And what was a bit surprising to me is that for all models we have studied, including several other ones, the deformation of the QNM pattern is very specific to each model. We have never found two meaningful models that give rise to the same modification of the QNMs. And even, for example, the frequency shift, which is something which would be quite easy to measure in the future, just the sign of the frequency shift can already allow to exclude several models, because in some models, there is no other way than to increase or to decrease the expected frequency of the QNMs. So if features beyond JR were to be discovered in future gravitational wave experiments, this would probably give us some information about modified gravity in this way. At this point, I would also like to mention an old idea by Hod, who pointed out long ago this interesting point. If we take a kind of Mukhanov-Bekenstein hypothesis, which is not supported, by the way, by loop quantum gravity, for example. That is, if the area of black hole is quantized through a quantization of mass, then, of course, we have a fundamental quantum of energy which enters the area spectrum of the black holes. And the question is, what is this fundamental delta omega here? And the proposal from Hod is that this delta omega has to be this log 3 over 8 pi m constant here, which is the asymptotic real part of the quasi-normal frequency for the Schwarzschild black hole. So this was an interesting proposal, but it was full of problems also, because it would represent the transition between a completely at rest and a fully excited black hole, and there is no strong reason for that, etc., and other more technical problems. Recently, Maggiore came back to this problem by a more reasonable proposal, that is to associate this frequency shift with a transition between two neighboring quasi-normal modes, between two overtones, I mean. The results are quite interesting, and I believe it would be interesting to go back to this problem in loop quantum gravity by taking into account the recent proposals that were not studied by Konoplia, and this would possibly put interesting constraints, or I think hints of the possible value of the Barbero immersive parameter. Okay, so let me now be slightly more specific on what I would call a toy model for quantum gravity. So this toy model was developed recently by Rovelli and Agar, and the basic ideas are very naive, very simple, and maybe for these reasons, quite convincing. So the reasoning is the following. One can define a curvature lens in this way, just by taking the appropriate power of the Quetschmann invariant. On the other hand, we have the Planck length. And of course, if we consider the ratio between the curvature lens and the Planck lens at the horizon of an astrophysical black hole, the result is teeny. And this is the usual argument to conclude that one expects no quantum effect at the horizon or beyond the horizon of a black hole. However, this statement might disregard a cumulative effect. So what Rovelli and Agar call cumulative effect here, it's just the naive remark that if you have a constant force on a free mobile, even if the force is teeny, if you wait 10 billion years, the mobile can now be at the speed of light because there is an integrated effect. Otherwise stated, if you look for 1 second, every nuclei of carbon 14 is stable. But if you look for 10,000 years, most of them have decayed. So when you time integrate your quantum process, something can happen. So for this reason, they suggested to use as a kind of measure of the quantumness of space-time, this new parameter Q, which is basically the product of the proper time and this Quetschmann invariant. So the proper time is related to the Schwarzschild time by this obvious formula, and then you can explicitly write down the value of Q by computing R in the background of a metric of a Schwarzschild black hole, and you end up with a very simple formula, which for any value of T has an extremum, and the extremum is for this value of R, and this is the little miracle, if you want, because the value of R, which appears here, is outside the black hole. Okay, 2m, of course, is the event horizon, and this 2m times something greater than 1. So it could be that time-integrated quantum effect seen from the Schwarzschild observer, of course, because this formula here is absolutely mandatory, is maximum just outside the event horizon of the black hole. So we investigate whether this nice idea could be measurable or could be seen through quasi-normal modes. So the problem, of course, is that we have no idea at all of what could look like this quantum correction. So we decided to be very conservative and to just take a metric which is given by the Schwarzschild term times a modification, a Gaussian modification, which is completely parameterized by a position, a width, and an amplitude. And then, of course, we can vary the parameter to fit basically any model you want. So the results are the following. This is the imaginary part versus the real part. Once again, different values of L and different values of N when you go from the bottom to the upper points. The black points are the Schwarzschild black hole, and the blue points are this little model. So the interesting points are the following. You can plot, for example, the relative variation of the real part of the frequency when you compare this model with Schwarzschild, varying the position and the width of the Gaussian perturbation to the Schwarzschild metric. The interesting point, which is not unexpected, is the fact that the maximum quantum effect appears for mu equals 3 in mass unit. So mu equals 3 means 3m. 3m is, of course, a very special point if you keep in mind the shape of the potential, which is maximum at this value. So it's not surprising. And as expected, when the width of the perturbation increases, we, of course, are less and less sensitive to its position. You can play the same game with the imaginary part, that is the damping rate. And very interestingly, it changes sign. So it is once again maximum around 3m, but it flips sign around a given point. And you can also play the game to change the sign of the f function, because you don't know if you increase or if you decrease the value of f. So we wanted to have results usable for any model, I mean, and not only in the case of the Rovelli-Agar toy model. So what we did is first to remark and to check precisely that the relative shift of the real part of the frequency happens to be linear in A. A is the amplitude of the perturbation. I mean, maybe it seems trivial, but I think it's not. At least to me, it's not at all trivial. It could be highly nonlinear. There is absolutely no reason for the shift of the frequency of the quasi-normal mode to be linear with this perturbation. And we have calculated this coefficient x for different values of the multipolar number, and for different position of the perturbations, and for different widths. So here we have a width of 1.5 in mass units, a width of 4. We have different values of L, and we have different positions. The Rovelli-Agar toy model corresponds to this value of mu. Remember, it's just outside the event horizon. So this corresponds to the red dots. And as you can see, that's cool, because it's not very far from being the maximum. So you really expect a strong effect in this model. We did the same for the imaginary part, so I won't bother you, but if you need all the numerical values are given in the papers, you can use them in any other situation. And the conclusion is the following. Now we have this general framework that is set and which can be reused by anyone who wants to investigate whether his preferred model has a noticeable influence on the quasi-normal modes. But we can also come back to the Rovelli-Agar model and try to guess whether the orders of magnitudes are compatible with an experimental detection or not. So of course, the amplitude of the modification depends on time. The longer you wait, the bigger is the integrated effect. And it depends on the inverse mass squared. And that's normal, because of course, the heavier the black hole, the smaller the curvature at the horizon. So it is obviously decreasing with n. And if you put numbers with our result, you end up with the result that if you want the effects to be measurable, basically the mass for a lifetime of the order of the age of the universe should be of the order of 10 to the minus 8 solar mass, which is basically the mass of the moon. So if you are an astrophysicist, you are very unhappy, because you say, but this is teeny. This is much, much smaller than one we see in real life. And that's correct. But if you are a theoretical physicist, you are very happy, because it is way larger than the Planck mass. It is incredibly larger than the Planck mass. So it means that even if this value is smaller than any known black hole in the universe, it is still extraordinarily big when compared to the Planck mass. And it means that quantum gravity effect might show up in large black holes. You could also play the game to put here a time which is higher than the edge of the universe, because we are here in a kind of loop framework. So there might have been a bounce of the universe. And Bernard Carr has explicitly shown that black holes could survive the bounce. So in principle, the edge of the black hole could be larger than the edge of the universe. And therefore, you might have quantum effect even for very large black hole. But to be honest, this is a bit too speculative for me, so I would not really bet on putting here a time which is much larger than the edge of the universe. Okay, in the same paper, Rovelli and Agar advocate for the Hayward metric, which has the advantage of showing the correct time dilatation between the inner black hole and infinity. and also to reproduce correctly the effective quantum corrections to the Newtonian potential. So this metric takes this form. And we have once again calculated the QNAMs in this case. And the result is that if you want, for example, the variation of the frequency to be of the order of a few percent, which is compatible with the accuracy expected for the LISA experiment, then the L parameter, which appears here, should be of the order of 0.7m. So this is not very good news because, you know, on a dimensional ground, you expect L to be of the order of the Planck length, right? So here it means that if you have a big black hole, you would need L, which is here, to have a value which is way larger than the Planck length so that the effect should be measurable. So this is not impossible at this stage, but if you take natural values, the effect would be actually T. Okay, just for the sake of completeness, let me mention that there are many other ideas for quantum effects in large black holes, not only the idea of Rovelli. For example, Giddings have a lot of excellent arguments that I will not summarize here, but just in one sentence, his point is that the inconsistency of black hole evolution with the principle of quantum mechanics, given the Hawking effect, motivate the need to modify the classical description even at horizon scale. And below this is basically the value of the page time, which means that something quantum should happen very quick in the evaporation of a massive black hole. And this requires quantum gravity effects to play a role even at the horizon scale. So going through quite a lot of calculation, he end up with the result that if this reasoning is correct, we might expect some variation of the images of the surrounding of black holes to vary at the scale of a few hours for a million solar mass black hole and at the scale of a few days for a billion solar mass black hole. And this is very exciting because this is something that the improved version of the Event Horizon Telescope might be sensitive enough to record. So this opens a very nice window. Okay, so let me now go back to polymeric black holes and to the other side of QNMs, that is to gravity factors. So in practice, the procedure to establish this metric, I think initially by Aleschi and Modesto, consists in defining the Hamiltonian constraint in the usual way. Both the Diffeo constraints and the Gauss constraints are identically vanishing, and the Hamiltonian constraint is solved by replacing, as always done, for example, in LQC, the connection by its holonomy, so I have to have operators associated with it. And the solution is expanded to the full spacetime by analytical continuation. So basically, we have a kind of exact mini superspace solution, which is extended to the full spacetime. This spacetime is geodesically complete, so it has been checked. And it constitutes a privileged framework to try to investigate the gravity factors. So you know that the Hawking spectrum takes this form. It is the usual thermal part. And the non-trivial part is this sigma term here, which encodes basically everything which is not thermal. So what is not thermal? For example, the fact that once a quantum is emitted, it can still be backscattered inside the black hole because of the very strong gravitational field, or if you want, because of the potential barrier entering its scattering equation. This cross-section can be calculated through the optical theorem, and we need to compute all those amplitudes to have an estimate of sigma. So we came back to this metric, so I will not bother you with the technicalities. But basically, just what you have to do is to write down your Klein-Gordon equation for scalars in the background of this metric, which is a bit involved because the function J and F are not the same, which is something rather unusual. So you see that the potential is not very friendly. And then you expand the wave in plane waves close to the horizon, spherical waves far from the horizon. You calculate all the multiple orders and you sum everything, and you end up with this result. So the Schwarzschild case is the blue case, which is just the one at the upper curve. And when you increase this polymerization parameter, you basically go from this blue curve to this red curve. Okay, you can do the same for fermions. So once again, I won't bother you with the technicalities. You have to go through the Newman-Penrose formalism. You write down your Dirac equation. You solve everything and you end up with a result which is quite similar to the previous one. And you can also play the game to vary not only the polymerization parameter, but also the fundamental ERA gap. So what can be concluded from this? Well, let's be honest. If we want to experimentally see loop quantum gravity effects, this is not the way to go. I mean, anyway, we have never seen a single evaporating black hole. So we are not at the point of observing small modification from the Hawking spectrum, which is anyway unobserved. However, it tells us something on the behavior of the theory. For example, we understand that increasing the polymerization parameter will just change the evaporation rate. Changing the area gap will change the energy repartition between the emission quanta. So there are quite subtle effects. And the conceptual point is that now we have all the machinery to have a full picture, because a few years back, with Karim, Nui, Alejandro Perez, and Xiongyu Cao, we calculated the evaporation of black holes by taking into account in LQG the discrete area spectrum, showing that, for example, we could measure in this way the Barbero-Emerzi parameter. And now we are in a situation where we both know the discrete spectrum of the area and the exact cross-section for the gravity factors. So it's not yet a full quantum gravity description of the Hawking effect, but at least we have all the different patches that are necessary to completely describe the phenomenon. Let me also, let me take this opportunity to come back to an older result that I obtained a few years back, but which is directly related about a local view on this Hawking evaporation. I mean, what do I mean by local view? I mean that usually when a black hole evaporates, one thinks as if the full spin network was reorganized at each step of the evaporation. But it might be meaningful to consider that, in fact, each emission of a quantum is associated with a change of a quantum state of a single, if you want, naively elementary area cell, which is, by the way, I think, supported by causality arguments. If you take this view, then you first recover the Hawking spectrum, which is, of course, necessary for the model to be consistent. Then it's very interesting as a phenomenological viewpoint, because here you go back to the Mukhanov Bekenstein hypothesis. So what it means is that the density of state is not any more dense when you go to classical black holes. And this has a very strong consequence, which is that the relative separation between the lines in the Hawking spectrum is the same, whatever the mass. So either at the Planck mass or at the solar mass, you have exactly the same relative width, relative separation between the lines in the spectrum. So it really opens the possibility to see quantum effects even for arbitrary high mass black holes. The technical point, which is quite, I think, interesting, is that this could be measured. I mean, in case, of course, we see an evaporating black hole, otherwise we cannot measure this. So why it could be measured? Because to measure that, you really need to look at the gamma rays. But the problem is that your black hole emits directly gamma rays with this very nice line structure, but it also emits quarks and gluons. The quarks goes to hadrons and many hadrons decay into gamma rays. So you actually have a huge background of gamma rays, even coming from the black hole itself. And the good point is that the line signal is not washed out by this effect, for a quite subtle reason, which is basically the fact that they are not emitted at the same time during the evaporation. I won't go into the details, but believe me, it works. And also the dynamics does not wash out this effect. This is not trivial, because what I mean here is that you begin at a given mass, you have a very nice spectrum of line. But as long as the black hole evaporates, the mass decreases. And as the mass decreases, of course, the position of the line is shifted. So it could be that at the end of the day, you recover a continuum. But hopefully you do not. So you can still measure that. And you could even measure some interesting LQG feature, for example, trying to distinguish between low J or high J, I mean, quantum number, dominated black holes. Okay, I told you about this isospectrality property of quasi-normal modes. That is the fact that the axial and polar perturbations share the same spectrum of eigenmodes. To me, this is a kind of miracle. I mean, this is really something strange. It has been numerically checked for several black holes in modified gravity. And it has also been numerically and even analytically checked that it is wrong, that isospectrality does not hold for some other theories beyond JR. So we just decided with my PhD student to go back from the original Chandrasekhar work, who was the first to really prove isospectrality for Schwarzschild black hole. So I won't go into the details, because at least to me, going through Chandrasekhar work is a kind of nightmare, but that's very elegant math. And we began not with a Schwarzschild metric, but with a general metric of this form. And we tried to understand whether the proof by Chandrasekhar could be generalized or not. So it really takes many pages of algebra. And at the end of the day, we have shown that the proof can be extended to this metric and only to this metric. So let me be clear. I'm not saying that other metrics are not isospectral. I'm just saying that the way Chandrasekhar derived his proof cannot be used. So it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that it cannot be proven in this way. So if you take his reasoning, you can just show that. But that's already interesting, because here you recognize, of course, a cosmological constant term, right? This is a cosmological constant. So it means that as a bonus, we have proved isospectrality for Schwarzschild de Sitter and Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter black holes. So quite a lot of algebra for a small result, but this is already something. So to finish, maybe I think I'm in the last part of the talk. Yes. So to finish, let me now go to this model by Rovelli, Vidotto, Agar, and a few others of bouncing black holes, which is very, very nice. So the idea is that for some reasons that I don't have time to explain now, it could be that black holes bounce with a typical time, which is of the order of m squared. So m squared is cool because it is smaller than m cubed. So it means that they bounce before evaporating. So it means that the Hawking effect could be simply seen as a kind of correction dissipative correction to the bouncing process. So this is the contraction, the black hole contraction, the white hole expansion. This is Minkowski, this is Schwarzschild, and this is the quantum region. So we have a nice phenomenology with this model. For example, we show that we can reproduce the Fermi gamma ray excess, you know, those strange gamma rays coming from the center of the galaxy. Of course, we have three parameters, so it's a kind of easy game, but it's not a trivial game, because it could have been that the secondary component conflicts with the astrophysical background, and it is not the case. We've shown that we have an interesting redshift dependence. So this is for bouncing black holes, and this is for usual, say, supersymmetric dark matter. The reason for that is very simple. When you look at a galaxy which is far away, it means that the bounce occurred in the past. So the lifetime had to be smaller, so the mass had to be smaller, so the black hole was formed earlier in the cosmological history, so the universe was hotter, and as what goes out is what went in, it means that the energy is higher, and this compensates for the redshift, and this is why this curve here is nearly flat. You can also investigate to which distance you can measure those phenomena. So this is the maximum distance at which a single bouncing black hole can be seen. So there are interesting structures. For example, the big steps are associated with experimental phenomena, just because here, for example, you have now huge Cherenkov detectors, and therefore you increase your detection capability. But you also have teeny steps here that are quite elegant and that are associated with the opening of new channels, because you now emit new particles that can decay into gamma rays and so on and so forth. This is insensitive to the initial mass spectrum, and this keeps track of the initial signal. What I want to mention here is basically this point. Initially, Rovelli and Vidotto proposed that this could account for fast radio burst. And this nice idea was suffering from a little discrepancy of three orders of magnitude in energy. However, we have shown that when taking into account the stochastic nature of the bounds, because of course it's a kind of quantum tunneling, so this M squared is not deterministic, then if the initial mass spectrum is peaked, it is very easy to exactly reproduce the measured energies. On the other hand, we now know that there are quite a lot of repeaters in fast radio burst, and I believe that it would be very hard to explain repeaters in this model, but it might be that there are different classes of fast radio burst, just as we have different classes of gamma ray bursts. Okay, last slide, I think. This model has also been challenged by another one from those gentlemen, Bianchi, Cristodolo, D'Ambrosio, Rovelli, and Agar, who actually consider that maybe the black hole is evaporating up to the Planck mass. When it reaches the Planck mass, then we have the classical instanton probability to tunnel into a white hole. And this white hole is metastable with a lifetime of order M4. The very important point here is that this M^4 is not the mass of the white hole. It is the initial mass of the black hole. And of course, this changes everything because the mass of the white hole is the Planck mass. So M^4 is one in Planck units. But the initial mass of the black hole, of course, is very different. And this is the key point. And then Rovelli and Vidotto say that this might be a very nice explanation for dark matter. And the argument was that the kind of mass you need so that those black holes have turned into remnants, but still that the remnants have not yet decayed, right, corresponds basically to the Hubble mass at the radiating time. So indeed, this was a good point. So we have recently submitted a paper where we try to really go into those ideas, and the results are the following. It doesn't work if we form the black holes at radiating, just for the same reasons that it doesn't work actually for primordial black holes. It's just because when those black holes evaporate, they emit basically too much entropy, and this conflicts with nucleosynthesis. So you just cannot have enough remnants by forming the black holes at radiating. This conflicts anyway with the formation of light elements. But they could be formed before inflation. The problem here is that it don't work neither, because in this case, the density would be anyway too high. It would be much higher than the Planck density. And we are left with the idea that it could be possible in bouncing models where we avoid inflation, for example, matter bounce model, where we both have a low enough density at the bounds, and we don't face this problem because we basically don't have inflation. So what we did is to really investigate this case in details, And we came to the conclusion that we still have constraints, you know, because those white hole remnants will decay stochastically in any case. We don't know exactly what they will emit. So we studied different extreme cases, so either very high energy quanta or low energy quanta integrated over the lifetime. And the result is quite interesting because the model is not excluded. So it's still possible, but it is constrained with respect to the original parameter space. Furthermore, it could even be possibly measured. So how? Maybe by the coalescence effect. So I have calculated that the coalescence rate could be high enough to lead to measurable consequences. But to be honest, I don't know to which consequences, because I don't know if one of you know what happens to two white hole merging. But this is something that, to my knowledge, has not yet been investigated into the details. So I don't know what would the signal look like. But I can tell you that the frequency of the signal could be high enough to be measured. I think I'm done. I'm done. Thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you very much, Aurelien, for the very clear talk. So let's start with a question from the students first, or the younger members of the audience, at least. Okay, Francesca.
I'm not the young member anymore.
I know, but young enough, let's say.
Yes. Hi, Aurelien. Thank you very much. There were really a lot of things in your presentation. It was very, very rich. So I have questions about different things. One question is about the quasi-normal modes, because you said that only in the polymerized quantization you can have effects out of the horizon. And this was not completely clear to me. Is it because you are differentiating from the treatment with Kantowski Sachs, or is it something else?
No, not only, unfortunately. I would say that it depends which model you have in mind. For example, there is a nice recent, quite recent model from Karine Nui and his colleagues. And in this case, you recover exactly Schwarzschild outside of the horizon. There are the older models from the Spanish team, right? Which also basically recover, not exactly, but they recover Schwarzschild with correction of the order of R divided by the Planck length. So it is Schwarzschild for me. So I don't know of any other attempt within loop quantum gravity that could lead to an important effect at the horizon scale. Or maybe it depends whether you for example, if you put the idea from of Carlo within loop quantum gravity, so that's different. But I think it's not specifically your loop ID, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. But this is specifically for the quasi-normal modes, then, not.
I don't think so. I mean, do you have in mind a black hole model in LQG where you have strong metric modifications outside of the horizon?
As you say, the computation by Haggard and Rovelli, but this was a very general computation.
Yes, sure. This I agree. But I think that the either the Spanish model or the model from Karim, or even the recent calculation also by Ashtekar, doesn't lead to any rich phenomenology. So I agree with that.
Okay, well, not to think more about this. Thank you. If I may, I also have a lot of questions on this last slide, because I really look forward to see the appearance online of this paper. I'm thinking about the conditions of coalescence. Are you thinking about the coalescence today in the late universe, so the probability for two remnants to collide, or are you thinking about the coalescence during the bounce? Because during the bounce, I may have arguments, idea about how to avoid it. I think also the work by Brandenberger on this can give some intuitions on that. But also,
I have considered the time-integrated effect, actually. But I'm not sure we want to avoid it, because, I mean, on my side, I think it would be great if we have any, if we have a kind of experimental signature, because in my opinion, the conflicts we have with observation is really related with the evaporation. During evaporation, of course, we release a lot of energy, a lot of particles, a lot of entropy, etc. But the coalescence itself, to me, it's not a problem for the model. It's a good point, because it does not conflict with anything we know, but it gives us some hints of possible detections. So I would prefer not to avoid it, actually.
I see.
But of course, they are very light. So, you know, the coalescence rate for something which has a light of a grain of dust, Planck mass is a grain of dust. So it's huge viewed from particle physics, but it's very, 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 very light viewed from the astrophysical viewpoint. But still, it's non-zero, yeah. It can be calculated.
But the distribution in the late universe would be, yeah, as you said, okay, you were thinking at the integrated effect of the coalescence. I was just thinking that in the late universe, those objects would be very sparse.
Yes, I agree.
Few of them in our solar system.
You are right. We are dominated by the early times anyway, because currently the number, the density is extraordinarily small. Sure.
Thanks.
I have a question. Thank you for showing the predictions of my modified gravity scalar vector tensor gravity MOG. However, you said that the model is under fibrological pressures. What are these pressures?
Oh, okay. So probably you should answer your own question. My understanding was that it was quite hard to account for everything that the model was initially expecting to describe currently, but I might be wrong. So please educate me on this.
Yeah, so new models are always subject to criticism, which they should be. But as far as I know, from all the papers that have been published, the applications to astrophysics, astronomy, and so on are, I think, reasonable at this point. But there's a lot of data. Einstein, for his general relativity, in 1915, 1916, there were three classical tests. Now the amount of data is enormous and awesome. And cosmology, galaxy clusters, all has to be fitted by a modified gravity theory. Otherwise it fails.
Thanks for the clarification.
Right, other questions?
Just a small one, Carla.
Sure.
First of all, Aurélien, I had to do a couple of things in between, so I followed the three quarters of your talk. I missed one quarter here and there, so I missed some steps. So, pardon me if I'm saying something out of place that you talked about. I want to make. First, a comment. This is wonderful, I think, this kind of work. This is exactly what we need. I mean, in spite of the uncertainty, the multiplicity of things, the missing point, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that quantum gravity community needs to do, I mean, to go toward these things. You know that I think that, but I wanted to repeat that. Then I wanted to make something about the lifetime of black holes. You mentioned the argument for M squared, and you gave a very clear account, short account of it. And there was a time in which I was enthusiastic about the possibility of M squared lifetime for the reasons that you mentioned. Then I got a little bit depressed because of the first spin form calculations that seem to go in the other direction, namely indicating that if there's a transition, quantum transition, it's later. I'm not convinced of anything for the moment. I think there is a quantum transition at some point. I think it's open. But last week there was a talk by Ed Wilson Awig. I don't know if you saw it, if you follow it, in which he has a completely independent way of viewing what happened on the long term to a black hole, which he came back from a sort of loop quantum cosmology like calculation applied to black holes, so to M squared. As yes, a lifetime. Yes.
The Mubar scheme, right?
But matter bounds, and he has an M squared time. I'm sorry? Oh, sorry, I heard something. So there is an M squared new result, theoretically, that supports that possibility, which has some exciting side about it.
Yes, thank you. I'm very excited by this. I think he used the Mubar scheme, right, in the framework of black holes. And I was also very, very exciting to see that M squared is coming back in the game. And I think he also has a slight deviation from a pure white hole solution. It's not exactly a white hole solution. So maybe also this opens some cool features.
Right, do we have our questions? Well, if that's in the case, I would thank Aurelien again.
Okay, so that's great. I will be able to catch the last bus and to be back home and not to spend my night at lab. So thanks.